our stories converge just because the perpetrators are the same. We often see these struggles in isolation, but they were all part of very deliberate planning.
None of that can start until we have a ceasefire, and it is only going to happen with immense public pressure.
The parallels there are appalling, and you can't hide from it. You can't not see this.
Because Palestinians, to some extent, are for all of us, we have to be there for them.
Welcome to Challenging Colonialism, a podcast dedicated to amplifying the voices of Indigenous California.
This is the third and final part in a very special three-part series. Part three explores solidarity between Indigenous Californians and Palestinians, with the focus on November 2023's Alcatraz Indigenous Sunrise Ceremony, which was dedicated to the Palestinian struggle for justice.
Please be advised that this episode will include graphic discussion of dispossession, ethnic cleansing, and genocide.
I am Rana Sharif. I use she, her, he pronouns. The story of our Nakba, that is the 1948 catastrophe, which resulted in the displacement of nearly 750,000 Palestinians. And I should bookmark and say that what we are witnessing in Gaza today is actually an ongoing element of our Nakba. The story of that Nakba has been removed from our educational system. So the attack on education, residential schools of Indigenous and communities, not being able to learn or speak Indigenous languages, we are witnessing that in Palestine. So the similarities are far too many. But also what's really important to think about is the way in which we've organized and be able to build community, I think is really important as well. And so that solidarity work and that kind of like allyship has been something that's really informed the way in which I even understand what it means to organize as a Palestinian here in Los Angeles, and to kind of center the experiences of Indigenous communities is really central to these parallels. So I think that obviously there are punitive parallels that we're seeing. And I think that that's something to name, but also the parallels in sustaining, life-making, supporting, uplifting. I will say that we as a Palestinian are humbled to be able to learn from our Indigenous communities in terms of what it means to not only survive, but thrive, to retain, to celebrate, to hold on to reinsert, to displace the state in life-affirming ways for Indigenous communities. But there are many parallels. And I think that central to Palestine solidarity work is really our commitment to Black Indigenous communities, forced migrants that come into the United States, and to kind of think about the ways in which state violence has a way of punitively impacting all communities. But really, when looking at indigeneity, Indigenous communities, we have a lot to learn from Indigenous communities in the United States.
Brittany Arona. So my name is Brittany Arona. I grew up during the years after 9/11. I was in high school, and the rampant Islamophobia that happened in those years, dehumanizing Palestinians, dehumanizing Arab people, dehumanizing Native American people here, dehumanizing Black people. I mean, Chinese expulsion, dehumanizing Asian people, peoples around the world. It's part and parcel for violence, colonial violence, that is necessary for these major countries, United States, Britain, Israel, like all the countries that vote against ceasefire or ending the occupation. They have to stand on the backs and exploit Black, brown, people of color. Like, that's just it. It's a function of white supremacy. It's scary to watch. But it also reminds me that nothing has really changed. What's happening right now happened in 1850 to us. It's important to me to use my voice in whatever way possible to speak out about this, because that is what Palestinians have been asking us to do. To use our voices and our platform to speak out. I am a scholar of California Indian Studies and human rights. And to me, it's necessary and urgent to speak out about these atrocities happening and as they're happening, and to be in strong solidarity with Palestinian people, and to not be afraid of whatever backlash people have been experiencing, because that's real. But the more we use our voice, the more we collectively come together, it's harder for them to justify what they're doing. I couldn't live with myself if I didn't say something. If I can offer one small thing, it's that. It's just using my voice and speaking out and using the platform that I have as a California Native scholar whose people survived a horrific genocide and are still trying to get our lands back and still pushing back against the state government and federal government and still saying that these violent acts occur here through the environmental violence. Missing and murdered Indigenous women, girls, and people. We still experience horrific statistics. These are things that are still happening for us here in California. It's so important to be in solidarity with Palestinians and all people around the world who experience injustice. All people in the United States who experience injustice. Solidarity really matters, and it's important. And I hope more of my colleagues start speaking out, and I'm glad that this podcast will come out and people will see that there is a legacy of solidarity with Native people in California and Palestinians. And so it's very important to me to do what I can.
My name is Jennifer Mohannam. The different types of genocidal practices that each community has had to endure, the elimination of entire villages, the repurposing of it for either colonizer communities or also the extraction of natural resources, while that could function both in settler and non-settler contexts of colonialism, I think that plays a big role in the dynamic of the colonizer-colonized relationship. So in the taking care of the land versus exploiting and extracting from the land, I think that's another way in which we relate a lot, I think, Palestinians to Indigenous communities and other places. For example, in Palestine, whole villages have been completely destroyed, and then on top of them have been created these national parks, these Israeli parks, and they've grown like foreign agricultural landscapes on top of like a native village and native lands, and then Palestinians can't access those lands. Their original homes are destroyed, and then their sites where families go for picnics on the weekend or do hiking or things like that. I think with the federalizing of certain lands here, for example, that perhaps Native communities don't have the same kind of access to those lands as they did before.
So my name is Mark Mensch de Leon. I had the chance to visit Palestine in 2018, and I was welcomed there by literally the most generous, the most kind people that I have ever met in my life. I mean, it was an astonishing experience that I feel kind of bad about, because at the same time, I experienced, you know, in the briefest way possible, the kind of brutal occupation that they are under. I got to see it firsthand. And so I think like that experience, a number of people have talked about, like, you know, visiting the West Bank, in particular places like Hebron, where you have this like incredibly enforced apartheid system, that when you see that firsthand, like there's no way to unsee it, right? I think it's very similar to how people talk about, you know, the kinds of images that are coming out of Gaza right now. Like there's no way to unsee these things. And so there's a kind of motivation just based upon the fact that like you understand that these are human beings who are undergoing some of the worst experiences, you know, in the world.
My name is Renda. I'm a Palestinian from Jerusalem and from the village of Birzit in the West Bank, but I grew up in the Bay Area and I just returned here and live in Oakland now. Many years ago, I had this conversation with a friend that has really stuck with me all this time. And it was when his first daughter was born. My friend is from Jerusalem. So him and his partner had their daughter in a hospital in Jerusalem, where the entire staff and the nurses and the doctors were all speaking Hebrew around them. And him and his wife could only understand a handful of phrases. They didn't speak Hebrew, so they didn't really know and were completely disoriented during this really important moment of birth. And so it was incredibly alienating from them in this very intimate moment where, you know, you're at the mercy of the doctors, where you are trusting them to make sure your child is going to be safe, that your partner is going to be safe. And not only that, he was really distressed that some of the first words his child would hear would be the language of the colonizer and the occupier. And so he was telling me that he made sure to whisper the Shahada, an Islamic prayer, into her ear to induct her into the faith and to also declare her Palestinianness and to make sure, and this is what he said, that her tongue would be Arab. And so to me, this was really kind of described to me how a lot of the way that we feel settler colonialism as the indigenous population, as Palestinians, is through these structures of occupation and apartheid, like the checkpoints, like the wall, the roadblocks, and the various bureaucratic measures that we have to go through to even be named as a human. But it's more so the way that we really feel it and that it becomes ingrained in us is through these like very corporeal ways that we are humiliated and that we are made to feel alienated from our bodies. And so there becomes this place where we also have the ability to resist against that through things like speaking Arabic to newborn babies to make sure that their tongue is Arabic and that they feel Palestinian at the moment of their birth when everything else in that space is trying to assimilate them into this other world order. So there's all these different ways that people come to resist the overwhelmingness of settler colonialism through these seemingly minute daily interactions that keep us as a people united by centering on our identity and centering our struggle in every single practice and every single interaction. And to me, it's focusing on these daily embodied experiences of surviving under these incredibly violent conditions that have really expanded what the definition of settler colonialism means beyond its structures. And it's also opened up the ways to see what survival and endurance look like in the everyday encounter with settler colonial erasure.
There's also something about the way that, as I've come to learn, Palestinians resist, right? They have this amazing concept of samud, right? Which is steadfastness. And under those types of situation, over, you know, 75 years of occupation, one of the things that has, you know, seemingly motivated Palestinians is this concept of just going on no matter what, right? This like absolute steadfastness that, you know, goes back to the kind of interrogations and torture that they underwent by, you know, Israeli police forces. Like the term actually comes out of the prison system, and it's a way for them to sort of understand how it is that they are able to resist this massive colonial system that's arrayed against them. And by doing it collectively, like it's an absolutely, in some ways, impersonal, if I'm, you know, like, I think we can turn that into a positive turn, like an impersonal way in the sense that this is for other Palestinians, but they also understand that this is for a global form of anti-colonial work, right? Like their concept of samud is expansive and includes all of us. And so I think like, because Palestinians to some extent are for all of us, we have to be there for them, right? And so I think like that's another really important reason for supporting them for me personally, but I think impersonally in the sense that we're all in this together.
This is the moment that we unite for liberation. Across the world, we are rising together. Gaza will continue to resist.
Hestam, Natoyet Vanessa Escovedo, Ni Noro Makhepork Choki Ambus. Hi, my name is Vanessa Escovedo. This is happening right now, today. And just thinking about the historical aspects of this, like how did we get here? It just shows so much complicity among people, among nations. I'm talking about all kinds of nations. I'm talking about Native nations as well, right? Like we have all been very complicit since the Nakba in 1948. My dad's born in 1947, so my dad is like literally a year older than this. And I look at my dad, I'm just like, wow, you're like 76 years old. And just, it's wild to me to think that, you know, this is happening. And it's happening again right now, right, with the bombing and the continued genocide happening to Palestinian people. My mom luckily instilled a lot of activism in myself and my family. And I remember her teaching me about Palestine when I was very young. And maybe she didn't have all the words of settler colonialism and all these things, but she had told me like how wrong it was and how they're indigenous. And I didn't know how really to speak to that for a long time. And then growing up, I remember I went to a protest with my friend Ahmad, and just seeing like, no, this is exactly like our struggle. And that's when I think I really started to kind of myself investigate, you know, the historical aspects of Israel and or the creation of Israel and the genocide against Palestinian people. And it's been something that's been super close to my heart and something I do for my daughter now, right? I make sure that I teach my daughter all of these things, and I take her to protest with me to make sure that she understands, because, you know, my whole PhD is on Native American studies. I have focused on California Indians. I have researched so much genocide on my own people, my ancestors. And to see the parallels right now of history that Palestinian peoples are enduring is just ridiculous. The removal, their, you know, limits to access. They don't have medical care, right? Like we're bombing or Israel's bombing hospitals. I say we because the United States is definitely part of this. The parallels there are appalling, and you can't hide from it. You can't not see this.
My name's Karina Gould. I am the tribal chair for the Confederated Villages of Lashon Nation. There's this idea of a creation of a new place, right? It's like, how do you go to someplace else and create something new and then totally eradicate everything that has been there for thousands of years? Well, let's just talk about how California Indian history, right? It's like the mission systems, right? The missions that we were enslaved at. We were missionized in both Mission San Jose in Fremont, California, and Mission Dolores in San Francisco. Mission Dolores started in 1776. America has this weird way of thinking about America was created all at once, right? It's like they don't understand this whole idea of colonization and how it happened over periods of time. So I always, when I do my talks for public, I was like, think about this. 1776, Spanish missions, the first part of our colonization happened at the exact same time that they were signing the Declaration of Independence, way on the other side of the country. These people over there on the East Coast didn't even know we existed, right? So there's these other colonizers that are here on the West Coast at the same time, but really with the same mindset. This idea of taking of the land, the breaking of the spirit, the taking of the sacred, the extinguishing of women as leaders, and then the changing of the landscape, the naming, the renaming of things that are sacred. It's like, I think that, you know, we don't actually think about history in this country. We just think that everything always has been here. All of those different ways that history repeats itself because we don't learn from it. You can't learn from it if you're never taught it either. And I think that, you know, the United States does a really good job at forgetting and covering up the histories of genocide that happened on these lands to create what is now called America.
My name is Layla Sharif. They all took notes from each other, you know, and one important thing about Palestine was partitioned the same year as Ireland, the same year as India, the same year as Kashmir, by the same people, right? By the British. So, I mean, our stories converge just because the perpetrators are the same, but also, you know, there's more texture to that story. It's very interesting how we often see these struggles in isolation, but they were all part of very deliberate planning. That connection needs to be made more. And what's interesting to me is like, this country is how old? You know, it's like a couple hundred years old. These places have been around for thousands of years.
Our songs in California were always about joy, right? Our songs were about this way of being. And I see that joy and abundance there with our relatives in Palestine. And then I also see what it looks like to all of a sudden have scarcity brought into a place, that there's not enough, and how that changes the demeanor of people, how that changes our psyche as human beings, what that does to us to cage us in a smaller area, right? So the Spanish mission period did that to us for 99 years. And then they set us free, right? As you know, Martin, you did all of this work on missions, right? They set us free to go where? To lands that had then been given to somebody else. This also has a tie. So the land was given to somebody else. Wow. Similar situation with what happened in Palestine. All of a sudden, somebody could create a land there that they now call home. But what does that mean for the other people? Then the people that were there, the indigenous people, my ancestors became the workers for those people that came here. They were not seen as equals. They were seen as less than, right? That there was this subordinate human being that all of a sudden was there to provide you with services rather than to be seen as equal partners on a land that had always been there. And then there was all about mass extermination. So you could see this correlation of exactly what happened. We happen to have three different colonizations that happened in our territories with the United States government, then just really just about extermination policies of California Indians. And so our people hid or ran or did whatever they needed to do in order to survive, right? And that's what happened. You do whatever you need to do in order to survive, to protect your family, to protect your land and your way of life. And that correlates with what is happening in Palestine right now, is that people in some way have to resist. Even in the mission systems, we resisted as people, right? It was not this docile people that just all of a sudden just walked into these walls. Well, I can't even say walked into the walls because we actually built our own prison systems, the missions, right? But all of a sudden became docile and just did this work. There was always a resistance of human beings when other peoples tried to come and change their lives. It's natural.
My name's Morningstar Galley, and I'm a member of the Ajumawi tribe in Northeastern California. Right here on the Pit River, we had massacres that occurred 150 years ago, that the genocide is still so fresh for our peoples, that this is 3 to 4 generations ago that this has occurred. And where it really did, you know, there was an intentional extermination of our peoples. And so to try to paint that picture of bodies laying along our river, of the rivers running red with the blood of our ancestors, and to try to get them to even imagine it, to imagine the unimaginable. It took a lot of work and a lot of effort. And I think that what has been so difficult in this moment is that we don't have to close our eyes to imagine it. It's right in front of us. And we almost like can't look away from it on social media. You know, we don't have the privilege of ignoring it in that sense.
Right now, if you have Palestinian friends, reach out to them because they're struggling. This is a really hard time for the Palestinian community. We have seen at least 1% of Gaza get wiped out in a matter of 2 months. And that's still ongoing. So my first thing is be a good friend and try to look out for your friends that are Palestinian. If you're joining them at rallies, you know, walk with them to their cars. And there's a lot of ways that our community is extremely hyper-visible and vulnerable right now. The other thing I would suggest is that there are ways, I want to call it intentional spending, because apparently boycott, you're not allowed to use that term anymore. But in thinking about individual choices that we make and understanding how they're connected to a lot of these things that we've been talking about today. So, for example, Sabra Hummus is a hummus manufacturer, the largest hummus manufacturer, co-owned by PepsiCo. It's an Israeli company. And they manufacture straight out of a settlement, right? Right on top, like in people's houses that were living there just not very long ago, maybe a few years ago, they've created this booming business on the backs of my people and our lands and our villages and our towns. So don't buy those things, right? And it's very easy to find out what they are. There are, I think there's a website or an app you can download called No Thanks. And like you can put in a brand and find out which ones are complicit in these global atrocities, not just in Palestine, but in the Congo and I mean, and elsewhere.
I think that's really, really important to note is that while we should be listening to Palestinians first and foremost, you know, it is clear that Palestinians are asking for us to speak as well. They're asking for everyone to speak. And because of the forces that are arrayed against them, the more voices that exist speaking about this, the more protection there is for everyone. And so I think it's like Palestinians first and foremost, but everybody's voice is incredibly important right now.
My name is Noor Judah. I mean, honestly, everything that those who have been advocating for a ceasefire and an end to genocide and for a liberated Palestine have been doing over the last several months is to continue doing it. Do not let your foot off the gas now. I know that you're tired. We are all beyond exhausted at this point. I know you are disheartened. But if the ICJ ruling this morning tells us anything, and the South African case that was quoting videos that so many of us shared in the last several months teaches us, is that we are making the case as much as they are. Every time we share something, every time we talk, every time we step out onto a street to protest, every time we conduct a teach-in, every time we insist on a conversation with our neighbors, every time we call a congressman, Palestinians in Gaza will, for better or worse, rebuild and learn what, you know, the day after and what the week after and months after and years after are going to look like. I don't know. But I know that none of that can start until we have a ceasefire. And it is only going to happen with immense public pressure. So, you know, continue to advocate. And if you are just now getting involved, seek out your community organizations. There are many, and they are more than happy to not only have you be a part of their efforts, but to educate you with love.
We've already faced so much catastrophic loss at this point, and our mourning has not even started. But I think that the tide has irreversibly changed. And I think that there is so much repression right now because there is a recognition of that. And there is a fear that this is going to topple the structures of power. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but probably in the next generation. And so that keeps me hopeful and keeps me moving forward.
Sometimes we got to be willing to be uncomfortable, say things in spaces that you know that you might get pushback on. But you need to say it. You need to say something. And I think the biggest thing right now is solidarity with Palestine. But the fact that like Palestinians are being literally massacred in front of our faces and people aren't doing anything. And we know this from our ancestors, right? Our ancestors went through the same thing and it's atrocious. And we're seeing it right now live. It's happening today. So say something.
I am speaking to you at a moment when Israel is actively taking our land, threatening to take more, and engaging in a genocidal project of erasure. If anyone is following the brave Gazan journalists who are telling the story, Mu'taz, 9-year-old Lama, Bisan, Plastia, or any of the number of Palestinian journalists risking their lives to share the atrocities happening in real time in Gaza, you'll know that when you see a lot of the people in these camps, first they were north and they were forced to displace south, and then they were forced to displace again and again, all the while suffering aerial bombardment in a huge nightmarish situation. The folks that these journalists are speaking to say, we want to go home. We don't care if our home is made of rubble or has become rubble. We don't care at this point. Death is pending everywhere, but we still want to be home. Even in the moment of pending death, we still yearn to return home. And we can tell you where that home is, and we can tell you how we got there, and we can tell you the people who planted the trees.
My name is Dr. Stephanie Lemston. How I honor my kinship with Indigenous peoples all over the world and Palestinians right now is by moving with some conviction and naming these violent systems for what I know they are, and encouraging people to trash them, really, like throw it away because it's in the way. Imagining our futures with the state, like saving what could be saved from the state, is really getting in the way of the futures that we could build and the relations we could make when we throw the state out. Who knows what could be possible? The state takes so much. It occupies so much of not only our homelands, but our imaginations, our mental space, our dreaming worlds. who knows what could happen if we say we don't need it anymore. I think we could live in balance. I think we could have homelands that hold us all.
I have been attending the Alcatraz Sunrise Gathering my entire life. It's part of how I received my name was the Sunrise Gathering that took place at my birth, where I was born, which was at the AIM for Freedom Survival School, which is also known as the Oakland AIM House. And so born into a moment of time where these gatherings were taking place as a way to honor the Alcatraz occupation, as a way to honor Indigenous resistance. In 1969 to 1971, there was a 19-month long occupation that took place on Alcatraz Island that was led by Richard Oates, who is of Mohawk descent. Richard was a student organizer at that time. There were many Native students that were involved with both Third World Liberation Front and the fight for ethnic studies, the fight for us to be able to tell our own truth and our own narratives on our own behalfs and have the autonomy to do so within the classroom and academic settings. And so with the occupation, there was a school that was built on the island, and that school was known as the Little Red Schoolhouse. There were a number of student teachers that helped to teach the kids who were, you know, the children of the occupiers. That school then transitioned after the occupation to Oakland, California. And that is the school that I grew up attending from the age of 2 to 11 years old. So this is known as Hintel Kuka, which still exists today as the only child development center in Oakland that is a Native American child development center. So these were my educators. These were my aunties and uncles that I'm still very much in contact with to this day that, you know, gave us a curriculum that was very much outside of our public school curriculum, where we were being forced to these lies about Columbus finding us and all of those lies and myths and narratives that we have been working over decades to change now. We were being told the truth about who we were and the strength and really the beauty and essence of who we are as a people that have overcome so much. And so these Alcatraz gatherings that take place every year, these sunrise gatherings that are held every October and November, they started before I was born. They started, I believe, in 1975 or 76 are the oldest flyers that we found. A few years after the occupation had ended, it was a way to not only honor those veterans of ours, those occupation veterans that we recognize and that we honor, but to recognize the spirit of resistance. It's Dr. Lenita Warjack that says Alcatraz is the spark that lit the flame of Indigenous resistance. And so from Alcatraz, there were all of these occupation movements of DQ University, Yakeyama. Up in my homeland, we had Four Corners, what was known as Four Corners, where our tribal relatives shut down the highways and collected tolls. We had the Indians of all tribes and Richard Oakes and his family come up to Pitt River, where we hosted them, where really prominent leaders such as Wilma Mankiller came and learned from our elders and learned about sovereignty, learned about autonomy, learned about the land claims, where our tribal members were fighting cases where they were being charged with trespassing. And we fought back really hard and said, there's no way that we can trespass on our own lands. And so I started attending the Sunrise Gatherings as a small child. I believe that my parents have even said that, you know, well, my mom was pregnant with me. They were in attendance. And so it just naturally was something that I attended on an annual basis. And then probably around 2007, 2008, I was asked to start organizing the gatherings. And I started bringing all of my children. I have four children from the ages of 10 to 20. All of my children have gone since they were in their cradle boards and baby baskets until now. And it's just a really special event and special gathering to have both that connection in terms of the ceremonial songs and dances that are offered, but also continuing that spirit of resistance and having those solidarity statements that are offered that very much continue on that spirit of resistance and Indigenous solidarity all over the world.
I actually had been to the sunrise ceremony before last year, and I thought it was an incredibly powerful grounding experience that allowed us to come together to uphold a counter narrative to the very violent myth of Thanksgiving and to honor what we know as the truth of the deliberate extermination of Indigenous people on this land and genocide that this country is predicated on. So I had already had this experience once before, and it was very powerful. So I knew I would want to go back. And also when I lived in Boston many years ago, I had the chance to attend the annual Day of Mourning at Plymouth Rock, and I went for those same reasons. And I remember there, it was definitely a little bit different. We had a march, for example, and I was struck by many of the chants that were centered on this phrase that was also painted on all the posters, which is, "We are not vanishing, we are not conquered, we are as strong as ever." And for me, that was like a call to action. It did not feel commemorative. And for me, that felt so important because I think when we start talking about commemoration or talking about these days that we do annually, we can easily slip into the state of observance that can feel very passive, like that we're just like doing a remembrance and acknowledgement of something that happened in the past, rather than affirming that this is an act and a continued struggle for land back that is ongoing and that is very present today. And so I remember thinking about that a lot when I came back from both of those actions, about how much these were acts of preservation and to recommit the community to the ongoing struggle by paying homage to fallen ancestors who fought for this land and to continue to carry that mantle into the future and for future generations.
So it's been the last 20 years now that AROC, the Arab Resource Organizing Center, has always been attending the Sunrise Gathering, always provided statements of solidarity, always had a contingent of their members. And it's really a personal connection in terms of friends that I've been organizing with for over, you know, the past 15 to 18 years. It's not just seeing each other once a year, but really learning how to be in relationship and connect on these issues together.
As things began to ramp up over the last few months about what's happening in Palestine, this isn't work that had simply happened. This has been ongoing work, showing up for each other, for the West Berkeley Shelman, showing up in different spaces that other people have had, and showing up at synagogues, and showing up at rallies, and showing up at mosques, and showing up at federal buildings for years, that this has been our work to connect these things together, because it's all interconnected. This whole thing with Palestine, it was like trying to figure out how do we do this, because it was so heart-wrenching and so close to the heart, because it was so apparent how much it was parallel to what we have dealt with here in California.
It was always something that not only was ingrained in my life's path, but also as just a part of who we were as a community. But I definitely remember this moment where there were Palestinian youth that came over to dance during the Sunrise Gathering. And it was just such a powerful experience. I was 18 or 19 myself. And so to both witness and understand not only the, you know, the sacrifices that were made in the journey, for the youth group to travel over. I had been a part of a number of traditional dance groups as a child myself. And so to witness the children and understand what it meant for them to travel over to Turtle Island, to what is known as Yalamu for the land of Ohlone peoples, what is known as occupied San Francisco, California, and to be there in one of our sacred places was just really touching and just really memorable. And I think that since that time, we had been organizing for Leonard Peltier. We had been organizing at that time against these various wars, war that was taking place in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and understanding that settler occupation was not only something that we experienced as tribal peoples, but was still being perpetrated throughout the world and along those very same lines, right? For resource extraction, for land theft, for the mass killing of peoples that did not fit into this white settler narrative, that it was about capitalism, that it was all about colonialism. And so I think that for myself and just being informed by those experiences, it was really important that as October 7th happened this year, but even previous to that, that we always ensured that we had and welcomed those organizers and those activists that stood for a free Palestine, that stood for liberation of Indigenous peoples, and recognizing the similarity within our struggles. And so as I've been coordinating the Alcatraz Sunrise Gatherings for the past 15 years, I've kept that in mind. And through those experiences, you know, understood that this has and always been an Indigenous issue, and that it was always important in terms of Indigenous solidarity, worldwide solidarity, to have that space for our relatives to be able to share their solidarity statements, to be able to bring their flags. And just as we fight for visibility, just as we fight against erasure as California Indian peoples, welcoming and joining with our Palestinian relatives who are very much fighting for the same thing.
So last year, you know, since October, I had been personally dealing with feeling really suffocated and alienated from the physical world around me here living in Oakland. And I actually, because I had lived on and off in Palestine for so long, this was the first time that I actually was in the U.S. since 2009 during a moment of a major war and a major war on Gaza. So it was a completely different experience for me. And I found it incredibly alienating because sometimes, you know, like it was hard to walk down the street and see people living their completely normal lives when I felt like I was in this completely different world and I was bearing witness to these horrors every morning, every time I looked at my phone, and yet the world continued on.
Just recognizing that coming together, literally breaking bread, sharing food, sharing some tea and a meal, and being able to sit together and just spend time together and build those relationships in that way is really, really necessary at a time that there's just so much bloodshed and the death toll is rising to an unfathomable rate. And so it just felt really natural. And to have that moment to see over 100 flags and have them all join together in the circle, have the traditional dance, traditional Duck Bay dance. And then we said, you know, very similar to round dance fashion, we're just going to have everybody join in. And they did. And it was a really special moment. And it was a moment that was not only needed for healing, for what we've all been experiencing, but it was a very prayerful moment in terms of, you know, we're just going to bring both the ceremony and the action and the protest all together in the circle. And the energy from it, I just got so many responses of people that just were so very touched by it. And yeah, I think that there's nothing more to say other than it was necessary and it continues to be necessary in terms of the support and the show of solidarity, and in terms of both honoring and recognizing and stating that this is absolutely an Indigenous rights issue, Indigenous rights violations, and, you know, speak to the many parallels around land back and land theft and ongoing colonization of Indigenous peoples.
I think a lot of Palestinians who live in diaspora and exile articulated this to me too. And this was like something that we were really experiencing, particularly in the first couple months of this horrific moment. And also, I really felt that immediately after October, it had triggered this latent memory of growing up in the 9/11 era and having to make a case for why you and your people deserve freedom, and to continuously combat criminalization and demonization of my people, of myself, of my belief system. And it just felt incredibly dehumanizing in that moment and incredibly alienating and a little bit triggering of those traumatic times that we never thought we would see again, that we thought we had learned from those moments. And secondly, it really felt that since October, it's really felt like time has just really stopped and nothing else matters anymore except what we are doing right now, which is bearing witness to genocide and doing everything in our power to bring an end to it. This is layered on top of dealing with immense, unparalleled grief and mourning and death and contending with catastrophic loss at a scale that I've never dealt with in my life and have only heard about from my ancestors. You're also going through all of these emotions and feelings that are so contradictory. There are these moments that you're completely elated and you start to witness the tides turning and people are coming to demonstrations and people are organizing and people are learning about Palestine and starting to recognize and understand what's going on. And you're starting to feel that maybe this is the threshold and liberation is on the horizon. And you really start to tangibly feel that. And it's so hopeful. And then there's these other really, really dark moments where you feel the world powers crushing you and you become hopeless and the loss becomes unbearable. And for me, sometimes that just completely freezes me and makes everything feel and seem impossible. And I think that going through all of these ebbs and flows and carrying all of these things in your body at once, like both the hopefulness and the determination and the belief that change is coming, and the grief and the pain and the hopelessness and feeling crushed, and also the capacity to be able to love despite being so criminalized and dehumanized. I think all of these contradictions coming together and existing all together are kind of foundational to the meaning of resistance and steadfastness. And them coming together and ebbing and flowing is what keeps our political movements going forward. And that's also created and sustained intergenerationally through community and kinship and through our collective practices. So on the day of the sunrise ceremony, I was personally feeling on the lower spectrum of those feelings, just feeling completely severed from the world and having a lot of difficulty dealing with the unfathomable amount of death that we were just witnessing and experiencing every day. I think the sunrise ceremony last year took place maybe around the 50th day of the genocide, about a month and a half into this. I think 15,000 people had been killed at that point. Most of them were children. We were starting to see the destruction of hospitals and also the media like completely rejecting that that was a war crime. That was the time when we first saw hospitals being destroyed, and now more than half of hospitals have completely stopped functioning. At that time, Israeli officials were just constantly in opening talking about flattening Gaza. It was like the first of those horrifying sets of videos of Israeli soldiers gloating about demolishing homes and looting them, and just the complete dehumanization of Palestinians on a grand worldwide scale. And at the same time, even though there were all these sustained protests across the nation, nothing was changing. And people were being punished for being in solidarity with Palestine. People were getting doxxed. People were losing their jobs. It was just, I remember that feeling, really that crushing moment at that time by the end of November. So at the sunrise ceremony last year, the programming was very focused on Palestine and Gaza. There were many Palestinian speakers that were invited, the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, the Palestinian Youth Movement, high school students who had been staging walkouts regularly in San Francisco at that time were invited to speak. And all of the speakers in general were mentioning Palestine in some way or making a nod or a gesture towards Palestine. There were Palestinian flags everywhere. People were wearing Free Palestine shirts. There were community elders from the indigenous community that were wearing huftas over their traditional dresses while they were doing the rituals. It just felt like a refuge from the rest of the world, a place that felt safe, where we felt held. Whereas as a Palestinian, I felt that I was just completely understood in all my contradictions without having to explain why, without having to explain anything. And that in itself, just extending and dedicating the ceremony to the Palestinian cause in one of our darkest hours, just felt like a great act of love.
And so again, whatever we can do in this moment, however we can support, however we can be of service to our relatives. So whether that's through ceremony, through action, through prayer, all of it is needed at this time. Tolokwitu.com, all my relations, and we mean all of our relations.
I felt that by inviting us as Palestinians into the ceremony so intentionally, by centering us, by centering our grief, it was not only an act of love, like I just said, but it was also an invitation to deepen our traditions of resistance together, to carry us and remind us through the experience of the indigenous community that we have shared dreams and imminent liberation, even in the moments of our darkest grief. And I think that was incredibly powerful to feel that, and to feel that we were really fighting this joint struggle together. So I think part of the ceremony that I think I'll carry with me for a very long time is, so at the sunrise ceremony, there's a lot of traditional performances and rituals that have been preserved over generation and passed down. And it's a really beautiful celebration to see these cultural traditions that have stayed and sustained and been passed down, and to see them beautifully played out in the present. So as the sun was rising that morning, there was a Palestinian dance troupe named El Jazur who was invited to perform Debke, which is our traditional dance that's usually in a circle formation while we're stamping our feet in unison. And we often dance it at celebratory occasions like weddings, but it's also become central to our cultural resistance. In the early years of Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza after 1967, Debke, alongside other cultural expressions like the colors of the Palestinian flag, were actually criminalized by military law as part of the crackdown on culture. And so Israel actually arrested many of the Palestinian dancers who were in the national Debke performance troops, and they destroyed their studios, and they attempted to destroy and fracture this cultural movement. And Debke, despite that, continued to be performed everywhere as an act of cultural resistance. So in that sense, Debke essentially has become part of the language of protest for Palestinians. It represents unity, it represents survival, it represents samud and steadfastness, and it even is another way to narrate our history that's constantly being erased, because many of the moves tell of Palestinian history and tradition. So that morning, once El Jazur performed, they started inviting people in to join the circle and to learn Dabke. And then suddenly it felt like there were hundreds of people who were in the circle clasping hands and dancing together and stomping with their full strength and chanting Free Palestine and Viva, Viva Palestina so deeply from their souls. And I just remember the line was moving so fast and everyone was doing Dabke with so much passion. It felt like I was being carried in this wave. It almost felt like a trance in some ways. And it was just such a special experience because in that moment when I felt so incredibly alienated, I felt that there was this new surge of strength from our Indigenous siblings here who were inviting us into this space, inviting us onto their land and doing our cultural dance of resistance with us and protesting with us. And they were telling us, you're not alone, we're here with you. It felt like we were all saying that with our bodies. And it really reminded me of that phrase that I kept seeing many years ago when I went to the Day of Mourning in Massachusetts, which is, we are not vanishing, we are not conquered, we are as strong as ever. And we were saying that so viscerally with our bodies together. And that for me, it was a really special experience that I will carry with me for a long time and will be something that I will look back to in my memory when I'm feeling defeated and feeling like having difficulty moving on. And I think it'll carry me through. And I think that was really the strength of that day, was thinking about our tradition and our culture and coming together without having to emphasize so much what our overlap was and where we see the similarities between our movements, because it felt so understood naturally. And that was really, really special in that moment.
Thank you for listening to Challenging Colonialism. There are resources and links on each show page for all three episodes, and we hope you will share this series with your communities.
As a podcast dedicated to breaking down patterns of ongoing colonialism, we recognize the necessity to help illuminate the commonalities of settler colonial violence happening in Palestine right now. In this episode, you have heard from Dr. Laila Sharif, Karina Gould, Dr. Stephanie Lumsden, Dr. Mark Minch De Leon, Morningstar Ghali, Dr. Noor Judah, Rana Sharif, Dr. Brittany Arona, Dr. Rhonda May Wabi, Dr. Vanessa Escovedo, and Dr. Jennifer Mohanam. Thank you for listening.